And I'm going to turn things over to our instructor today, who is Eric Nold, who is an on-scene coordinator, or OSE, coming out of EPA Region 7. Eric, are you ready?
Sure. Thank you very much. And as Jean mentioned, I'm not sure. I think I'll just cover all the bases. And good morning, good afternoon, and good evening. I did take a quick look at the list of people for this seminar, and got quite an area covered here. And so even though I've given this training probably 100 times, it's the first time I've actually slightly been nervous, because I generally have an audience of 30 to 50 people in front of me, and I know that I got over 160 people, and I'm staring at a computer instead of people right now. As Jean mentioned, though, also, I do want questions to come up as they arise, and this needs to be an interactive course. I'm going to apologize in advance if there are people that don't currently have internet access, and so they aren't going to be able to switch back and forth, because there is a visual portion of this presentation that is slightly important, and you can always go back to it later and review these videos that I'll be switching over to if necessary, so you'll understand at a later date what I was referring to. But basically, how I've been doing this presentation and this training for a number of years now is for the last 10 to 15 years, I've been kind of dubbed the Mercury guy in my particular region, and so I've get all of the Mercury questions and calls shipped over to my phone wherever they come in, and I've accumulated these questions over time, answered quite a few of them, and it comes down to just a handful. They can all be kind of purged into this handful of general questions that if everybody understood the basics of Mercury a little bit better and the properties of Mercury a little bit better, they'd be able to answer a lot of their own questions. So this presentation is really just a quiz and walking through the quiz, and basically it creates a lot of additional questions as you're going through it. So that being said, one of the main focuses of this presentation is going to be to try and get everybody up to the same level of understanding of the basic properties of Mercury, and therefore be able to understand how and why we respond the way we do, especially in our region and across the country here. Going down to slide two, I apologize. This is a couple of these slides I've left in here because of other presentations I'm doing in the future and a couple I just got done with. But this slide number two just shows an example of a house pre-Mercury spill and then down below a house post-Mercury spill. Going to slide three, saying with the school pre-Mercury spill and post-Mercury spill. And this is kind of a take off of the old, this is your brain on drugs, where they're frying an egg. Anyway, this is important for us because we do a lot of outreach efforts in our region. And we've combined these two simple little slides here into an actual banner that we take to a lot of our presentations. And it generates a lot of good questions when we're at conferences. Let's go on down to slide number four. This is the simplest of the questions you'll see today. Question one, what are the three forms of Mercury? And we can go on down to slide five. And the answer is obviously is elemental, organic, or inorganic. And the reason I even leave that up there is because I want to make sure that everybody's aware this presentation is going to be strictly on elemental Mercury and with respect to Mercury spills. Focusing mainly on residential indoor spills, but we will kind of lead into other spills also. But if people are online because they're hoping I go into mercury levels in fish or mercury problems with inorganic salts, that's not what I'm covering today at all. I'm going to strictly be speaking on elemental mercury. Slide number six. We're going to spend quite a bit of time on this slide here, one at a time. The basic properties of mercury. These are straight out of a NIOSH pocket guide, basically. A lot of these, and several of these are just out of textbooks or out of reports or papers that have been written on mercury. And these are all actually true. The problem is, as you'll see as we go through this, they're all very, very misleading and misunderstood properties. The first one at point here is mercury vapors are invisible. That is correct, and now I'm going to apologize again if I lose people, but this is where we're going to be starting to switch around. if everybody goes to the very, very bottom, slide number 47, and click on slide 47, and then click to the additional resources, and you'll see the videos. The video I want people to click on now is the one entitled Mercury in a Jar video. So you go over to the blue round button under view, click on it. You could also have gone through the link that I had put on that slide number 6. Anyway, so here I am many years ago with a jar of elemental mercury. I think I was 2 thermostats that we'd cleaned up, and I just hadn't had a chance to dispose of it yet. This is a Versalum black light that has a special wavelength of black light. And what happens is if you put a source of elemental mercury between a black light and a fluorescent backdrop, you will actually see mercury. You'll actually see a shadow of mercury vapors. Mercury vapors are so dense that the black light cannot penetrate, and so you'll end up with a shadow of the mercury vapors going through to the fluorescent backdrop. So, yes, they are invisible, yet at the same time, you can trick them so you can see them. And hopefully now everybody will be able to. I think this constantly loops, so if you... Eugene, were you following me on this, and is there a way to specifically hit a specific back button to get people back to the presentation?
They can continue to use the back button in their browser to bring them back to the slides. If I could recommend anything, rather than having them using one web browser, I'd have them click on the home button and open it up in a new window, and then navigate to the additional resources page so they can have that and kind of toggle between the two screens. And just so that you know, we did update your slides as well, so that there are screenshots of the movies on the slides. Even if they can't get to the movie, they get a gist of what would have been played back in the video.
Well, the online version I'm on at the moment, I've just lost using the back button, and so I'm going to be going back to my downloaded version and going from just the downloaded version, so I won't have a live version for a little while. And I don't know if there's other people that are having the same issues where they got booted or not, but hopefully most of the people online had downloaded the presentation. Which is the case on my other laptop that I have set up, so I'm able to switch back to that downloaded version and go back to now slide number 7, which basically is a picture of those screenshots that you mentioned. If there's a few people that have the opportunity to come off mute and let me know whether or not that video was able to be seen and whether people were able to get back in before I continue on. Otherwise, I will have to try and figure out a way to
This is Joe Bannon. I was able to watch the video. It didn't loop, but stopped, and I got back. I did take her advice, though, and opened up now that resource, the additional resources in a new window.
Okay. Can you do that for me, Todd? So that, okay, there we go. I lost that for a while. All right. I'm back up and operating correctly again. Okay, so basically, like I said, you know, it is invisible, yet there is a way to trick it so you can see it. The next one is slide number 8, is mercury vaporizes at room temperature and higher. We're gonna cover this a little bit more in detail on another question later on, but this is a huge pet peeve of mine, because you'll find it in all the documents and all the reports written up about mercury. And yes, there's nothing factually incorrect about it, but it is grossly misleading, and I'll explain a little bit more of that in detail a few slides down the road here. So then we go down to slide number 9. Once again, we're going to cover this in a little bit more detail on another slide, another question, but mercury is insoluble. That's the way it's written, and you know, if you look it up in the NIOSH guide, that is what it says. And I'll go into a lot more detail on that a little bit later on why that is misleading also. Well, just right off the top real quick, if it is insoluble, why would we even have a method for analyzing mercury in water samples? So that gives you a quick clue right there. The next one, slide number 10. Vapor pressure is less than 0.0012. And the main reason I have this slide in here, most of the people I train on mercury spill response and awareness are firemen and hazmat technicians. And the reason this is so important is because the first thing that a responder at that first responder level does whenever they go out to one of these releases is pull up the chemical on the roof in the NIOSH pocket guide, look at what the vapor pressure is, because that tells them what kind of respiratory protection they need. The general rule of thumb is if it's less than one, they probably don't have a respiratory issue. So this one being 0.0012, you know, they look at this as a rock. It's not doing anything. There's no respiratory issues with that. And we'll see later on how grossly misleading that is. Well, if you just think back to the video we just looked at, did that look like it was not vaporizing at all? Of course not. It looked like a big cigar was going off in the bottom of that jar. So then the next one down would be, actually, I think we're going to switch over to some more video real quick. So, switch down to, I've lost it again. Hold on a moment. I want to switch over to the broken mercury video. Basically, what had happened was I did that little video in a jar many years ago, and I showed that to a colleague as Region 5 who took it and showed it to Ohio EPA. I know we got I saw that there should be several people from Ohio EPA online. And Ohio EPA took it to the next level and created a whole bunch of videos that are just excellent videos. And I've been granted permission to take a lot of these videos and utilize them for training purposes and education and outreach. What you're seeing right now on the mercury one is just a single thermometer that was broken open on the top of a carpet and smashed, or actually this is not where it's smashed in, it's just sitting, the beads of mercury from the thermometer is sitting on top of a carpet. And you can visually see how much vapors are coming off of that using that black light experiment. If you were now to switch over to the next video, which is the mercury vapor after carpet cleanup, this is an example of where the mercury had actually been stepped on and smashed into the carpet a little bit. So keep an eye on how much vapors are coming off at the beginning of this video, and then compare that and contrast that to after the fact whenever hazmat technician uses a very expensive mercury vacuum with a very powerful motor on it to suck the mercury, all the visible mercury has been sucked out of this carpet until there's nothing left to be seen, and then we try the experiment again. Now compare what the vapors look like. And what you'll see is actually we've made things way, way worse. Visually, you can see that the vapors coming up off of there are dramatically more concentrated and coming off more readily after the cleanup had been conducted than it was prior to the cleanup being conducted by using a vacuum. I use this little clip quite often to send out whenever I get calls and people say that, you know, they're responding to a mercury spill and the homeowner or the principal or the superintendent of the school or whoever's in charge of the building just refuses and does not want to cut out a section of carpet. I'll just send them this little video clip of this cleanup of a carpet to show them what happens before and after a cleanup on carpet. And we generally, I don't think I've had one in 15 years persons deny going ahead and ripping the carpet out after they've viewed that video. So it's a very, very powerful tool to use, this visual. So we're done with those two videos at the moment. And I'm going back to slide number 10 again, where this was just an example, a visual example, again, of the vapor pressure being less than one, where people would potentially think that there is no vaporization issues, therefore no respiratory problems with respect to mercury being volatile. And yes, it does have a very, very low vapor pressure, but obviously it does come off. Next one down, we're going to skip down to slide number 12. Vapors are odorless, and that's what you'll find in the NIOSH guide. And that's not an untrue statement, but if you go to that slide number 13, that's actually Clancy, the mercury detection dog. There was three dogs total in the world that I'm aware of that have ever been trained to detect mercury, and they aren't trained to detect mercury through their vision or keen senses other than smell. They can't actually smell mercury. So this one here happens to be Clancy out of Minnesota, who I believe is retired now. But that's just an example of it is odorless for humans, but it is not odorless. There is an odor to it, or else the dogs would not be able to be trained for it. So slightly misleading, but still true. Next slide down would be slide 14. Vapors are tasteless. That is also, I believe, a completely true statement. That's what you'll find in the NIOSH guide. Yet, I can tell you from personal experience that I have been in mercury spill scenarios in indoor settings where the concentrations were exceptionally high, and within a few minutes, before I had donned any respiratory protection, I could taste a metallic taste in my mouth. I'm attributing that to the fact that I had quite a few of the old mercury amalgam fillings in my mouth, and basically they were interacting with the high concentrations in the ambient air that I was breathing. And so, you know, rule of thumb is if you've got those in your mouth and you start tasting metal in your mouth, definitely way past time for where you should have backed out to don respiratory protection. And I'm sorry for slowing down. I'm doing a real quick look at the questions to make sure that they can be answered in a timely fashion with this. The next one down is the last one of the properties, and then I'm going to go ahead and go back to the question and answer it because this is the last point for the properties. And this one is the one that I'm leaving up there that is not misleading. Out of all those other ones, like, you know, I kind of showed you a little way that they're kind of misleading in how people have interpreted them. This one is absolutely dead on, straight to the money right here. Specific gravity, 13.6. Water is 1. Lead is 13.3, so you can get a sense of how that works. The issue here is that mercury is liquid. So I always tell the firefighters, you know, when you're putting out a fire on a home and you're spraying up in the second floor, where does the water always end up? Always end up in the lowest point of the home, the floor drain in the basement, if there is one. And water just has a specific gravity of 1, and it's a liquid. Think of a liquid with a specific gravity of 13.6. Mercury is basically 13.6 times better at finding the lowest point than water is. So just trying to get people a visual idea of how to think about mercury whenever they're responding to a mercury spill. Real quick on the question, is it true that mercury vaporizes at room temperature and higher? Would elemental mercury not vaporize from a pool of mercury at the bottom of a water body, which is colder than room temperature? We're going to cover that here in a little bit more detail on one of the other questions further down in the slides. And it may be one of the next slides pretty quick. Actually, no, it's going to be probably in about 15 or 20 minutes that I'll cover the answer to that question. Next question. See, we're only a half hour in, and we're already on question 2, so this is going really fast now. The question number 2, how much elemental mercury needs to be spilled before it poses enough of a problem to justify a response? And I get this question all the time. You know, somebody needs to put a threshold on whether or not we respond or not respond. People like to throw out 1 pound. People like to throw out a tablespoon. People like to throw out a thermostat. People like to throw out a thermometer, an oral thermometer. Well, the actual answer to this question, and basically the answer to almost every single question with respect to mercury spills, is down on slide 17. The answer is, well, it depends. And I know that a lot of people look at that and think, well, it's time for me to walk out of this class. This guy doesn't know what he's talking about, and this is a cheap answer and an easy way out. But really, this is the answer to all the questions. You cannot answer a mercury question with one piece of information. You've got to ask a lot of questions before you can answer the simplest of questions. So what's it depend on? Well, let's go down to slide number 18. Depends on a lot of things. We'll start with the top one on there, location of the spill. Well, what do we mean by that? Let's break it down all the way through. Location of the spill, is it indoors or outdoors? If it's outdoors, it may not be as big of a problem. If it's indoors, it could be. Let's continue on down the path of the indoors. Indoors where? Is it indoors in an industrial setting, in a warehouse where they actually use mercury and they have a ventilation system and engineering control set up for that? Or is it indoors in a home, in a private residence? Well, indoors where in a private home? Is it in a bedroom? Is it in a basement? Is it in a detached garage? So location, you got to go into extreme detail when you're asking about a location of a spill so that you have an idea of whether or not it's truly an issue. A further example of that is I've responded to quite a few thermometer spills, thermometer breaks, one of which happened, you know, I had a lady call in to our spill line.
Yes.
Said that we were the fifth phone call that she'd made in the last hour, and that, you know, if we said it was not an issue, then she would finally have to just assume that, yes, indeed, a thermometer break with the quantity in a thermometer is not an issue. So I started asking her the questions, and it turns out that she had broken the thermometer while she was shaking it down to take her child's temperature. Well, asked some more questions. Turns out the child was 2 weeks old. And she was shaking it down over the top of the crib, broke it on the side of the crib, and the mercury beads had fallen out into the crib itself. So I went out and responded to that in a very timely fashion, and sure enough, I found beads of mercury underneath this infant's mattress. Had we not gone out there and followed, you know, along with the health department who had talked to her, the poison control center who had talked to her, the hazmat team who had talked to her, the State Health Department had talked to her, a different EPA program had talked to her, the local health department, her physician. That mercury beads would have stayed underneath that infant's mattress for quite a while. We'll go into how long it would have been there for in another slide, but it would have been there for a long time frame. And think about a nursery, an infant's room. Is that kept it below room temperature normally? No, it's not. It's they're generally kept above 80 degrees for a newborn. So that's even worse. Another spill location where I had a call in, I think it was actually in the same year as that infant thermometer one, where the locals were insistent that we hurry up and rush up there on a holiday weekend. 10 pounds of mercury released. And once I started asking questions, it turns out that the mercury was in a subsurface impoundment outdoors about a block away from a new neighborhood. There was absolutely no one being exposed. There was no receptors, outdoor setting. It was a non-issue. Plus, it was wintertime. Told them to put some banner guard up around it, and we'd follow up on the following Monday. The location of the spill has a significant impact on whether or not you need to respond.
Much for when you're out there.
The next one is type of surface that the mercury is spilt on. And what I mean by that is whether or not it's a hard surface, whether it's a brand
Eric, yeah. I'm very sorry to interrupt you, but this is a reminder. Please place your phone on mute. We can hear a side conversation. Hit *6 if you haven't done so already. I'm going to give it another 2 minutes. If the conversation continues, I'll globally mute everybody, okay? I apologize for the interruption. Again, *6 to mute. Thank you. Go ahead, Eric.
Wow, globally mute, that's a lot of power. Whether or not it's a new hard surface that has brand new coating on it so there's no cracks, or if it's a very, very old hard surface, like an old hardwood floor that has a lot of cracks in it, whether it's a carpet, so it would have basically had a less violent hit and break up, whether or not the carpet is the short Berber versus the tall shag. The type of surface is extremely important on whether or not things can be cleaned up really quickly and easily, or if it's going to be extremely problematic. So that is one of the other factors that I depend on, whether or not it's necessary to respond. Kind of touched on this next one droplet or many, how violent the spill and the break was. Let's use an example of a thermostat on the wall about 4.5-5 feet up. If it breaks, you know, somebody threw a baseball and it smashes it, if it drops and hit the carpeting, basically those beads, the way they were falling, they're probably going to stay in that same amount of beads when they hit a carpet, whereas if they hit a linoleum floor or a ceramic floor or a hardwood floor, they're going to hit and continue to break up in smaller and smaller beads and then start rolling. So the type of surface or the amount of droplets will also impact whether or not there's enough of a problem to cause a response. Temperature is another very big factor, and we're going to go into temperature a little bit more detail, but obviously the warmer it is, the more volatilization is going to occur. So the higher the temperature, the bigger respiratory problem it's going to create. The length of time, how long ago how long ago did it still occur? If it's a very recent spill, you know, somebody calls up within an hour of a spill occurring, we can generally clean those up in a fairly rapid manner in an easy manner. Whereas if somebody calls up because they just now discovered that, you know, mercury can cause problems and it turns out they've got some health problems that make sense, but it was from a spill that may have occurred 3 years ago, mercury that's been volatilizing indoors for 3 years is now contaminated quite a large area probably by now. Anything that has a porous surface has probably been impregnated, or maybe not to the point of saturation, but has been contaminated by the mercury vapors. Then I think I've touched a little bit on who's being exposed. Is it somebody like myself, a middle-aged person with no current health issues underlying? Is it a newborn? Is it a newborn with underlying health issues? An older person? So who's being impacted? It has a lot to do with it. Is it a female in childbearing years? We're probably going to go out a little quicker if that's the case, as opposed to not that we're having preference, but we do have to take all these factors into consideration on whether or not a response is necessary and the timeliness of the response. A big factor is also how the initial cleanup was conducted. We get so many people calling in after, you know, they've spilt mercury from whatever the device was, tried to do a cleanup initially. How they did that initial cleanup, or maybe they didn't do anything at all, maybe they were savvy enough to know to close the door and walk out and get on the telephone and call in the fire department or a hazmat team. How that fire department or that hazmat team or the health department follows in and does their initial cleanup has a huge impact on whether or not it's going to be done right the first time or if this is going to turn into a prolonged event. I generally lay these out on a flip chart, and we can go on and on and on about all the factors. This trend of thinking, in order to properly respond to a mercury spill, it's kind of like the old, if you want to catch a rabbit, you got to think like a rabbit. This line of thinking is what I try to focus whenever I'm teaching responders who may or may not ever respond to mercury spills, the thought process that you got to follow down as you're en route to a mercury spill, and not just while you're en route, but before you even get en route, while you're talking to people on the phone to get the information. I've also, I uploaded a new document a little while ago before the seminar started, a sample draft questionnaire that people can print off and have sitting by their phone if they actually are people who take a lot of calls about mercury spills, where it lays out the thought process of what questions to ask and the order to ask them, so you can try to calm people and veer them down a correct path with respect to the line of questioning, so you can get to the information you really need, so you know whether you need to respond at all, or the timeliness of the response and how big the response is going to be. Going on to slide number 19. Actually, before we do the question number 3, I am a little ahead of pace, I think, for being able to finish this out. So I do want people that have questions to start throwing them up there so we can get this a little bit more interactive, or come off mute and ask your questions as we're going along. Question 3 is, what is the regulated quantity here in the U.S. for elemental mercury, which triggers the legal requirement for a spiller to call the National Response Center by law? And I think most of you are aware of this, that the answer to that is 1 pound. Well, what's wrong with that? It's once again, there's nothing wrong with that, but yet there's everything wrong with that. There's people who abuse that thought process of 1 pound. If it's not greater than 1 pound, they confuse the regulatory requirement of reporting with health risk, and nothing can be farther from the truth. There's absolutely no correlation with the regulated quantity and whether or not there's a threat posed by a mercury spill. The greatest example I see of misuse of this is in the medical industry. Doctors and dentists get so many mercury spills in clinics, and the physician or the owner of the entity refuses to call it in and to do anything that's appropriate because they say, well, it turns out it's under a pound, so I'm not required to do anything. You know, clean up what you can and move on. Well, that may be fine and dandy in certain circumstances, but what if that blood pressure cuff was broke open in a room from a gynecologist who sees nothing but expecting women? That's not where I want my wife to sit for 2 hours waiting for an examination when she's 8 months pregnant, knowing that, you know, there's probably beads of mercury left behind if it wasn't cleaned up properly. So, you know, there's, and the other side of this is why it's so right for 1 pound is because that's as low as we get. You know, obviously there's something, it tells you something. You know, anhydrous ammonia is what, a 1,000 pounds? And mercury is only 1 for an RQ? Well, what's that tell you? Well, it tells you how toxic it is. It's extremely toxic. Therefore, it has a very, very low reportable quantity threshold of 1 pound. And I'm reading as I'm thinking at the moment, so I apologize for slowing down here. And once again, the next question is actually one of the questions that will come up in another slide. This one, I guess, I do believe goes back to the first question. It says, at what temperature, if we go down to, I apologize here, go to slide 21, question number 4, at what temperature does mercury begin to volatilize? Well, you know, go back to the properties question and where you see it in every report and all the textbooks and everything, it says it volatilizes readily at room temperature. The key word here being readily. And people misunderstand and just take that, you know, room temperature is where it starts. No, it's readily at room temperature. It actually starts at negative, go on to the next slide, slide 22, negative 33 degrees Fahrenheit. And yes, that is a negative sign. Very, very, very low. That means that anything above negative 38, vapors will come off of mercury, elemental mercury. I have not personally tested the negative 38 because I've never, well, actually I've been close to that. I have actually, though, on one of the very first very big ugly spills that I ever went out on in Council Bluffs, Iowa, went outside when it was negative 5 and put some mercury in a pie pan and brought my meter out, and sure enough, I was getting readings at negative 5. So I do not doubt that this is the accurate number. Anything above negative 38 degrees Fahrenheit, mercury will volatilize. And we're going to go down to question 5 on slide 23, and I think this one will cover the second question that popped up on the screen. If thermostat, and I just threw in thermostat because I was using a known an item with a known quantity so I could make some calculations. If thermostat was broke in a house and mercury was not cleaned up, approximately how long would it take for the mercury to completely volatilize to the atmosphere and no mercury would be left? Well, everybody should know the answer to this. I'd already told you what the answer to everything was. And the answer, of course, is it depends. And it depends on several factors, but then if you take the formula to calculate this and change each of your assumptions, and this formula is based on 100% assumptions. Everything is in a perfect world, perfect scenario, perfect setting, which is never the case, obviously. So this number that you're going to see on the next slide means nothing but a theoretical. What it is, it depends. And what it does depend most on happens to be, and if you go down to slide 24, it depends mostly on surface area, whether or not it remained in one bead, in which case it would take about a year, or if it broke up into about 1,000 beads or droplets, in which case it would be a theoretical 1 month, or 10,000, 2 weeks. That's all theoretical now. There is no such thing as it being in a perfect setting where this is a based on the formula where everything remains constant. That's what would happen. This is grossly misleading. Also, I have to leave it in here, though, just to give it a sense of the fact that it's going to take a long time. It's not going to go bye-bye on its own in a week. It just isn't going to happen. An example of that is if you look at what happened up in Region 5 because of the mercury gas regulators that were taken out of service. I'm forgetting now. I'm thinking it was in the 1970s and 1980s. And back in the late 1990s and early 2000s, Region 5 went and the states went back up in and started looking at the potential for mercury spills in thousands and thousands of homes up there. And yes, they found mercury in many of these homes still from where these mercury gas regulators, which contained, I believe it was a teaspoon of mercury, had been improperly removed and the mercury had released out in people's basements and the mercury was still there. That's 20 plus years and the mercury was still there. So obviously it didn't just go away because it's not a perfect system. So this slide we're looking at right here, slide 24, is all theoretical. It's all you need to know, it's going to take a very long time and it's probably not going to go away by itself. Physical cleanup and removal is going to be necessary in order to do it in any sense of a timely fashion. Going next to question 6. Which is slide 25. If an elemental mercury spill is immediately cleaned up with a household vacuum, will it really pose a health threat? And I used to say this one's, an automatic where it doesn't depend, but in reality it does depend. I have recently had some homeowners who said they hit it with a vacuum right away and did exactly the wrong things, but then followed up really, really quickly with exactly the correct things. And when we showed up, because things just were, the stars were aligned and luck was on their side, the cleanup didn't go any further. There was, the concentrations were low enough that it didn't cause an additional response. The stars being aligned was that it was a very small quantity. It was on a hard surface. It's easy to clean up. They realized what they had done as soon as they did it and took the vacuum outdoors, went in and re-wiped it down with cloth and took that outdoors. Most of the time, probably 99% of the time, though, if an elemental mercury spill is hit with a vacuum, it's the worst thing in the world that could happen, and it's going to lead to nothing but more and more problems. Think back to the video that we watched 15 minutes ago where we hit it with a $5,000 specialized mercury vacuum, and it was twice as bad after we did that than it was prior to doing that. So the answer, it depends, but it's most likely that's the worst thing you could do. So you go down to the next slide, being slide 26. And I'm going to real quick kind of read through a couple more of these questions so I can see whether or not I need to continue on or follow through with some of these questions here. And I think, let me scroll down and see if any new ones. I think I've covered the first three. And yes, I just covered that the mercury vacuum does make the situation worse in the short term, always in the short term. During a removal action of a mercury spill, you will cause a greater vapor problem than prior to. Whenever you start agitating the mercury, it will increase the volatilization of the mercury, and you will get more vapors initially. I've done numerous mercury spills. You get in, assess the situation. You may have the highest concentration in the whole room that the spill had occurred in. Might be in the range of 10,000 nanograms. You start doing the cleanup. You walk in while they're doing the cleanup, and those numbers have spiked up to 30,000 nanograms. So the physical removal of mercury will increase the mercury vapors initially, and having a specialized mercury vacuum is no exception. Does that mean I'm not suggesting that I'm telling people not to use a mercury vacuum? Absolutely not. The mercury vacuum does recover the vast majority, the bulk. You know, you got to go for the gusto. The bulk of the mercury has to be collected, and in some state, most of the time, a mercury vacuum is going to be the quickest way to do that. Just don't think that that's not also creating an additional increase in mercury vapors at the time that it's occurring. If you actually set up a ventilation system in the room that the vacuuming is occurring in, so that you can get those vapors outdoors quickly, that's the best case scenario, where you actually set up a ventilation system prior to initiating the vacuum and the cleanup, so that you're controlling the increase. You know that you're going to increase the vapors and set up a ventilation system in advance to account for that. Let me go to a couple more questions here to make sure I'm not falling behind. Boy, every time a new question pops up, then I get scrolled back down. The next question I've got here was that are there published data on events where above PEL or TLV concentrations of mercury are documented? Almost every spill I've ever been to is above a PEL or a TLV. Concentrations of elemental mercury are almost always greater than those numbers initially when a spill first occurs, and definitely while the cleanup is in progress. I think I'm caught up on the questions now, so I'm going to go down to slide number 27. Which is question 7. Can you properly declare a mercury spill area clean based on visual inspection? And once again, this is another slide that I leave in here mainly for the local responders, the health departments, the fire departments, the hazmat technicians. And the answer to that question is no. Go back to the example I gave you of water, or water being specific gravity of 1 and mercury 13.6, and mercury being 13.6 times better at finding the lowest point as water. Mercury being liquid and having such a high density will always find a place to hide. And there's always going to be a case where you're not going to be able to see every single bead. Therefore, you cannot, with all confidence, say, without having an instrument or an air sample collected, that all mercury has been recovered and removed and there is no concentration exceeding any problem level. That being said, is it done? It's done every day. We can't expect and don't expect that every single first responder is going to have an instrument for detecting mercury. Think about this. Are there long lines at the hospitals waiting for people to get in because of mercury poisoning? No, there's not. They do the best they can, and sometimes they do not have the ability to get a mercury detection device there to verify that the cleanup that they do is adequate. But most of the time it's done adequate enough that it's not causing a long-term problem. Once again, though, that being said, the only way to truly know for sure if all the mercury has been cleaned up to an adequate level is to actually have a specialized mercury vapor analyzer or an air sample collected from the area of the spill. So that goes down to slide number 28 with the answer, and I think I've already basically covered that. Down to question number 8. Kind of inferred to this a little bit already, but slide 29, question number 8. What is more harmful, swallowing elemental mercury, absorbing it through your skin, or inhaling it? And once again, I used to say this is another one where the answer isn't depends. But then I had to change that a few years ago back to, once again, the answer to that question is it depends. And if you slide down to slide number 30, what's it depend on? Well, never say never. We have had a couple of cases in my region now where teenagers have attempted suicide by swallowing large quantities of mercury. And yes, had they been able to keep it down, then swallowing mercury would have been worse. We've also had a case where the young teenagers were carrying the mercury around in their shoes to conceal it from the adults so they wouldn't get in trouble. And it turns out that the soles of your feet are some of the skin on the soles of your feet are some of the most absorptive surfaces on the human body. And so the kids that were they're carrying it around in their shoes ended up on that spill being more sick and having more long-term health problems than the kids that were playing with it and just inhaling it, the vapors, because of the absorption nature, the absorptive nature of the soles of the feet. So never say never. There's always, you know, an exception to the rule. But back to inhalation, that is 99% of the time, inhalation is the worst route of exposure for mercury poisoning. With respect to elemental mercury, and once again, I'm not going to go into inorganic salts or organic mercury. So inhalation is the worst route of exposure, and that's what we're most concerned about, and that's why we have these mercury vapor analyzers and respiratory protection when we do these cleanups. Going down to question number 9 on slide number 31. Every year I go back and forth on whether I should remove this slide because I've only found one other person that thought I was crazy, wasn't crazy whenever I was even mentioning this, but I can still remember growing up, you know, old school style and seeing, I don't know if it was in my parents or grandparents or somebody's house growing up, that they had some mercury. They had it in an old mason jar. They had, you know, it was visually it was obvious mercury at the bottom, and then they had a layer of water on top of it, and then instead of a lid, they just had like a piece of cheesecloth or cloth or something over the top of it with a rubber band, and it was just sitting on a shelf down in the basement. Anyway, so the question is that sufficient? Will that water actually act as a barrier for the mercury vapors so that there's no risk, there's no exposure coming off of the mercury if it's sealed with some water. Now this goes back to now the properties that were misleading that I skipped earlier about the solubility. Recall now in the NIOSH pocket guide, it says mercury is insoluble. Well, it turns out that's accurate for elemental mercury itself, but the vapors are not. The vapors are highly volatile. Well, unless it's negative 38 or below, which means you're not talking water anymore, you're talking very hard ice, the mercury is volatilizing even into the water, and then once it volatilizes into the water, it's extremely soluble. The water can only hold so much before it reaches saturation, and then once it reaches saturation point for a soluble mercury, it just shoots right through the water column. And so the answer to that question is it depends. It depends on how fresh the water is. If the water has been there for a while, and if you go down to, I'm sorry, go ahead and skip to slide 32. If the water is fresh and hasn't reached the saturation point yet, then it will actually act as a barrier and inhibit the mercury from escaping. However, if that mercury has been sitting there for a while, or if that water, I'm sorry, has been sitting there on top of that mercury for a little while, and I don't have the exact number for this because it would depend on there's a whole too many factors to calculate this, but rule of thumb is within two or three days, the water column is going to get saturated and you're going to get breakthrough and you're going to have vapors coming out through that water column. The main reason I leave this in here now is once again back to the fireman scenario I gave earlier about mercury being 13.6 times better than water, finding the lowest point in the house. The lowest point in the house in many cases is the floor drain in the basement. Well, what's in a floor drain? A P-trap. What's on the P-trap to keep the sewer gases from coming up, well, of water. So what happens in most cases on a lot of spills we go to, there's a really excellent cleanup that's been conducted. Last thing a lot of fire departments will do is spray down a cement floor in a basement into the floor drain, flush the floor drain, take a few readings. Everything looks great, and they walk away. Everything's good. The homeowner calls back a couple days later and says they still don't feel 100% comfortable until maybe an outside entity comes in and takes readings. I'll go into there and down the basement and get screaming high readings. Like, well, what happened? It was, 2 days ago there was no readings at all. Well, it turns out that they'd covered some mercury beads that were down in a floor trap, in a P-trap, with fresh water, and basically that was masking the mercury. Mercury was still there. They were getting accurate non-detects at that moment in time, but 2 days later, vapors had saturated the water column in the P-trap, and the vapors were shooting right back up through. And so you discover that a lot of times, and this goes beyond just fire departments and floor drains. You're looking at toilets, sinks. The sinks in particular I'm thinking of are high school chemistry labs. So during the school year, you may not get any readings in a chemistry lab in an active school, and then during the summer you can go in there or the first day of school before anybody's entered the classroom, you might get pretty high levels because everything's, the mercury was in the bottom of the trap and it has saturated the water column above it and you're getting vapors through now. So I'm going to leave this slide in here. By the way, I'm not the most intelligent out there, but I am smart enough to realize there's a lot of people on this that are a lot smarter than I am. And if I've been doing the same presentation now, just with some minor tweaks, for probably 8+ years, maybe into the thousands now of people I've trained. If people are aware that there's something absolutely incorrect or wrong that I'm saying here, please educate me. I am not one that still isn't, I'm still trainable and I can still learn, so please correct me if you find mistakes in this presentation or this training to make sure that I'm not carrying on wrong information for the next 10 years. I would greatly appreciate that. Okay, I'm going to real quick slide over to read some more questions, see if I'm up to speed. Gene, have you removed the ones that I've already covered then, so I'm on brand new ones at the very top? It appears that way. I got a question about why would you amalgamate a spill, and I can try to cover that a little bit at the end of this whenever I go through a quick scenario of a cleanup. And it wants to know, can you talk about the rebound effect? Oh, yeah, the rebound effect is a big problem, and I'll try and cover that a little bit when we go through a quick spill scenario on how to do a quick cleanup. And the next question is a drone meter recommended for measuring mercury in ambient air, or is newer, better technology now available? Basically, there's several different devices out there now. I'm not allowed to endorse any certain instrument or technology. There are others now besides Jerome's. Jerome's the one I started with many years ago, the old Jerome 411s and the 431s. They do have newer technology that they're using and better instruments with lower detection limits now, as well as other companies that are out there, the VM3000 tracker, Lumex's, and I think there's a couple others that I'm not thinking of off the top of my head. So there's numerous technologies and companies that make these mercury vapor analyzers. So as far as better technology, yeah, there's better technology now with much lower detection limits available out on the market, and it's pretty quick and easy to research that on the internet. Next question was, is there any peer-reviewed literature indicated toxicology or dermal or oral ingestion of elemental mercury? I was supposed to have I do have. Sue Castile is in the room now from the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, and I'm going to ask her to come up and read this question and think of an answer here in a little bit. I don't personally know the answer to that, but I'll hopefully have an answer before this presentation is over. We're going to go ahead and skip down to the next question then, being question number 10 on slide 33. What is the proper way to test a person for mercury poisoning? And once again, you all know the answer to this question, and it is, it depends. And what does it depend on? Let's go down to question number 34, and skip then to slide 35. It depends on how long it's been since the subject has been exposed. If I was to go out and somebody called and said they think they may have a mercury spill, and I go in and confirm, yes, indeed, this is definitely mercury, and they said, it, you know, well, it's been like that for weeks now, and what should we do? Should we get tested for poisoning? And I say yes, and they go to the doctor that day. Well, the best test in that case is going to be a blood draw. The issue is that a lot of times people will realize that there was a problem with the mercury spill, and they will remove themselves from the spill area. And it'll be 4 or 5 days, maybe even a week, before they even contemplate the idea of, should I be tested for mercury poisoning? And when they go in, they go to their local physician, and their local physician is not well-versed on mercury poisoning most of the time. And so they just do the automatic thing and draw blood and say it's good to go and send them home. Well, that actually won't be an adequate test for somebody who has not been directly exposed from mercury vapors for an extended period of time. If someone has been removed from a source of mercury for, you know, several days, the most accurate test is a urine test. Well, turns out there's multiple types of urine tests, and just the one-shot urine test is not going to be adequate either. Actually, the best test in that scenario, where it's been days since exposure, is going to be a 24-hour urine sample. Well, it turns out that's extremely difficult to get people to do. So the default for that would be, what's it referred to as, a morning? But if you can't do the 24-hour, the morning draw, first void in the morning is, I think, is what it's referred to. So you can do a one-shot urine if it is the first void in the morning urine sample. Then there is a technique to do the mercury analysis for hair, but it turns out that's actually that's for organic mercury levels and not for exposure to elemental mercury. And so, once again, you know, the answer is it depends. I'm going to go down to slide number 36, which is question 11. And now that I've got more people in the room, I'm trying to run two computers at the same time. Next question is question 11. What all devices contain mercury? Oh, well, obviously, there's a multitude, and this slide number 32 just has a very, very short list. I always leave this in my presentation because one of the things I learned from going to all these training classes is somebody will always have something new I've never heard of before as far as a new source of mercury. Or what it's used in or how it's used. And why is that? Well, it's because mercury is so unique, it has so many different beneficial uses. And I usually spend quite a bit of time on this slide, even though it looks rudimentary to most people on here. One of the things, actually, I think I do have a slide coming up. Yes, I do. The next slide. Let's go to the next slide, slide number 38, and I'm not sure if this will come up all as one slide or if it's going to go through one at a time, but basically let's go through the beneficial use properties, and so on the like the clocks and ballasts, the beneficial use property is the liquid weight or the density of the mercury. On thermostats and tilt switches, that's the electric conductivity of mercury. That's the beneficial use property. For barometers and sphygmomanometers, blood pressure cuffs, it's the known pressure sensitivity. And for fungicide and preservatives, it's the extreme toxicity. And I always try to talk a little bit about, you know, there's huge outrage several years ago, and actually it's come back up again recently because of vaccinations. The H1N1 vaccinations have reared its ugly head again with respect to the mercury being put in it, and nobody understands why mercury would be used in a vaccination. Well, it's for a preservative, and question being, you know, how does mercury preserve? What you know, does it keep it cold? Is it, you know, is it salt so that it kind of makes it like jerky so it lasts longer? Well, neither of those. It's actually the a preservative because of its toxicity. It's so toxic that nothing can grow in it. Same reason it's used as a fungicide. It was used in paints many years ago. They put just a very, very small quantity of mercury in large vats of paint being made, and therefore nothing could grow in it. They would not get any algae growing in the paint batches. So it's so unique and has so many different properties that it can be used in beneficial ways, even as extreme toxicity is used in a beneficial manner. I'm going to go into slide 39 here and reiterate one more time that I am actually going to be a little ahead of the schedule, so I should have plenty of time to answer questions at the very end to make sure all of them are answered. But the next one is kind of going through a real quick example of how we deal with spills and respond to spills from the EPA's perspective. Slide 39, on response, most important right out of the gate is to isolate the spill area. The quicker that it's isolated so that there's no spread, the easier the cleanup is going to be, and the shorter the time frame is going to be for concluding a cleanup. A lot of this is going to evolve around the next item being the interviewing or interrogation process. The vast majority of these spills occur from the accidental release caused by teenagers, and when you show up, they're going to be hesitant to give you all the information willingly right out of the gate because they are very, very fearful that they're going to be in a lot of trouble. And so it's very important, though, to ask a lot of very detailed and pointed questions repeatedly until you feel like you've gotten all the information. Sometimes it may take a week before some kids will fess up and give you the whole story of where it came from, where all it was played at, and who all was involved. Another one is during the investigation process of a spill. Make sure you're not one of the trackers. Do not, I don't know how many times we go to a response from a mercury spill, and another entity has already been there in front of us, and I don't know what it is. There's something about mercury that's like a train wreck. People actually have to see it to believe it or something and have to stare at it. If you're walking in with an instrument and the instrument goes off and says there's elevated levels of mercury, it's time to stop, turn around, and back out and verify you've got a thought process in place to make sure that you can decon so you don't become a tracker. There's absolutely no reason to continue forward with your instrument that's giving you higher and higher and higher readings just so you can visually see it. Not until you've backed out, made sure you've set up a decontamination process, whether especially for your boots or your shoes, whether it's for wet decon in a bucket or if it's going to be disposable dry decon with booties. Just make sure that you've got something in place that when you do walk in further so you can get a visual and see how big the spill is, whether it's two little beads or a whole room is full of glitter at the moment, and so it's obviously a huge spill. Make sure that once you walk into that scenario that you can back out without tracking. And then most important thing on a response, there's a lot of, out on the internet, if you do a search on there, there's a lot of devices, chemicals, compounds, you name it, that is being sold out there to clean up mercury spills. The bulk recovery of visual elemental mercury is probably 98-99% of a mercury cleanup, just physical cleanup. And that is going to take a long time and can be very tedious, a lot of hands and knees work. And once I also mentioned earlier about the focused ventilation while you're doing that. When you start agitating the mercury to clean it up and moving the mercury around, you are going to increase the concentrations of the mercury in the room that you're conducting the cleanup. You need to have focused ventilation so you know that those vapors are being pulled out of that room and back outside. Next slide is slide 40. Basically, there's during the increase of mercury spills and awareness, and especially like I mentioned, the ones up in Region 5, there needed to be a process put in place. And so Region 5 was the lead up in Chicago on putting together. Mark Darno and Steve Runninger, OS colleagues up in Region 5, had put together what's referred to as the Mercury Response Guidebook. And that's based on the next two slides, which are the six R's. I'm not going to go into detail on that, but it is one of the documents that's linked on the very last slide that you can go to, and it gives you extreme detailed information on conducting cleanups of mercury spills with respect to how EPA does these. And real quickly, though, like I said, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on these because I wouldn't do it justice, and this could be a whole class on its own, just going over the six R's in detail. But the first one is, the spill has to be referred to the EPA, and it's usually done through the local or state health department. Once we get referred, then obviously we have to get access from whoever is the owner of the property. Reconnaissance, and this kind of goes back to the last slide of how we do the initial assessment work. Once again, back to the instrument. Some instruments have lower detection limits and are more sensitive than others. Others have higher detection limits and are less sensitive. Either way, it does not matter. There's absolutely no reason to put an instrument down near a bead of mercury to take a reading. If you can see beads of mercury, you don't need a reading off of it. It is going to be high, unless it's negative 38 degrees outside. If you do, you're going to end up fouling your instrument, and you may be down for quite a while. So no reason you do not need to take a reading directly above within an inch of a bead. I can assure you it will be high, unless it's negative 38. Relocation, a lot of times, if concentrations in a home on a residential spill are greater than 10,000 nanograms, we're going to ask the residents to relocate while we're conducting the cleanup, because that's the level we consider unsafe for habitation. Also knowing that, because even though it may say it's 8 or 9,000 right now, once we initiate the cleanup and start moving things around, and the concentrations are going to go elevated up into the 20 and 30,000 nanogram range before things get better. It will always get worse during a mercury cleanup. The next three R's are on slide 41. And then after the going to the removal next, there's special things that we have to do at EPA to initiate a removal action. And you can read those. I'm not going to go into detail on that because that's what the guidebook really does. After you finally removed all of the elemental mercury and got the levels down to habitable levels and safe levels, then we would go into replacing the facility back to pre-removal conditions.
And can you interrupt and ask a question?
Go ahead.
Under disposal, one of the big things we see a difference on is how people actually treat the waste.
Hold on a second. I need to bump up the volume here. I can't hear you.
Okay, sorry.
Which volume? Okay, go ahead.
All right. One of the big differences we see in the cleanups, and especially with contractors, is the disposal of items that were either A, in a room, directly exposed and contaminated. Is it all hazardous waste? Is it all, mercury requiring to be torted? An example would be if you had a small office, an exam room and a doctor's office, they spill mercury onto the floor. I've seen it as burrs where the entire room was cleared out and all items thrown away as mercury contaminated. And I'd like to get your view on that, or how others handle it, because in the opinion would be that just because it was exposed to mercury doesn't necessarily mean it gets packed inside a drum and sent off as mercury contaminated articles.
That's correct.
Is there the common sense approach of even if it has some mercury vapors, it still could be considered a solid waste? Another factor is, even if it's like a chair, we've seen it with the chairs with wheels on them. The wheels are what's contaminated. Cut the bottoms of pull the wheels off and throw the chair away as solid waste and the wheels as mercury contaminated. So what's the other part of that is, even if you had a rug with mercury on it, what is a true test to see the levels of contamination? You know, if you pulled a TCLP sample, are you sampling the rug? Are you sampling the mercury? And even if you sampled the mercury, will it really leach above TCLP standards? Your thoughts.
Great question. And basically, I'm going to be speaking in general rules of thumb. General rule of thumb is, whenever I go down on a mercury spill, and I know that we're going to be the lead on it, I create three different waste stream types. Elemental mercury, the visual beads that we collect, I'll set those off in a jar. That's going to be one waste stream. A small, you know, whether it's a small spill, medium spill, or a large spill, we'll create one jar of just nothing but the visual liquid mercury. Second one was going to be a drum, which we know are items that have come in direct contact with mercury and are grossly contaminated, highly contaminated mercury items, where it's obvious that, you know, just the area where the visual beads were hitting the carpet, we're going to cut that 4x4 foot square out, or whatever, you know, whatever it may be, where it's visually contaminated, we're going to cut that out. Or if it's a couch, those cushions are highly contaminated. The odds of being able to decontaminate are very low. Those are the ones that are in direct contact and may still have some extremely small, very, very, barely visible beads of mercury on them. Those are items that are highly contaminated. That's going to get removed as a second line, which is going to be put in a drum. The third one is going to be the stuff in the area of the spill, maybe the same room or down the hall, that happens to just have incidental contamination from the vapors themselves. Maybe it's drapes in the room. Maybe it's wallpaper that came off because there's a certain type of wallpaper that got inundated with the. Those are going to go into a roll-off box or other drums and basically now, if we wanted to collect a representative sample of the slightly contaminated, it's going to pass TCLP every time, and therefore it's going to go off to solid waste landfill as a special waste. I've never seen that fail TCLP, that just the incidental contact from vapor contamination, where it's quicker for us to dispose as it is to decontaminate. Those items always end up being able to go to a solid waste landfill as a special waste. The drum itself, where there was gross contamination, direct contact with elemental mercury, wasn't just incidental because of vapors being in the area, that's going to go off to a retort facility. You may end up with one drum, half a drum, 5-gallon bucket, may end up with 10 drums, depending on the size of the spill. Those need to go off to a retort facility because the odds are, well, actually, experience has shown that the odds are a lot of times those will pass TCLP, but is it the right thing to do to send it to a landfill, a special waste, when you can see mercury? You know, it might be small beads, but you can see the mercury in it, and you know it's got high concentrations, but it may, depending on how the sample's collected, it may or may not fail TCLP. I'm still going to send those off to a retort facility, those drums. Then the jar of visual elemental mercury, I'm going to send off to a recycler, either through a household hazardous waste facility or some other means similar to that. Whether that's the correct thing to do nowadays with the quantity of mercury that the United States has in store, I don't know, but as opposed to going to a retort, which would do the same thing with it, it's going to end up being a stockpile at some point. So I always generate three different waste streams: the visual elemental, the highly contaminated in drums that go to a retort, and then the slightly contaminated and considered special waste that goes off to a solid waste landfill as special waste. Does that answer your question sufficiently?
Yeah, very good. Thank you.
Yes, good approach, and we have taken. Through the years, we've collected samples of all those to prove that is the correct way to go. And like I said, though, I have taken many samples of the drums that we consider highly contaminated, and numerous times they have passed TCLP, but we've almost always erred on the side of caution because you can still see visual beads in there that, you know, the right thing to do is to go ahead and send it to retort, even though it passed TCLP. Now, a contractor coming in and wanting to throw an entire couch away to a retort facility at high cost, when you know that just the rollers on the bottom could be removed, the common sense says remove the rollers on the bottom, throw them in the drum, and throw the couch in the roll-off box that's going to the landfill as solid waste.
And that's a problem we encounter sometimes. It's always after the fact. We as an agency leave the scene to get, every now and then we get a call from somebody saying, my God, look at this cost. And we weren't there and we weren't involved, and you just got to kind of shrug your shoulders. What happens when you have these outrageous costs, next time they're not going to report it. So it's always a concern of ours.
Okay, while we're in a question mode, I'm going to switch back to Sue left. I'm going to skip the question about the toxicology and go down to a question about the new compact CFL light bulbs, compact fluorescent light bulbs, how much mercury is in them. And basically, the original ones had up to like 5 grams, if I recall correctly, and the goal has always been to get down to not exceeding 2 grams, I think is what the industry is shooting for nowadays. That being said, let's go back to the very first question. How much mercury is needed to pose enough of a threat to cause a response? Have I ever responded to a CFL break? I have, because it was done in a nursery, and the initial time frame, if things aren't done correctly right after a CFL bulb breaks, it can cause a respiratory problem for the initial few days. What you're going to want to do on a CFL bulb break is just get everybody out of the room, walk away for the first 15 to 30 minutes, because that's the time frame where the vapor concentrations are going to be exceptionally high. We've gone in after CFL breaks, and we'll get anywhere from 5,000 to 10,000 nanograms on our instrument from a CFL bulb. That'll go down rapidly on its own, but it'll go down even more rapidly if ventilation is set in place properly. And then once that goes down, usually within a couple of hours, then you can just do a physical cleanup of the broken glass, and that's going to end up taking care of your cleanup on a CFL. That being said, never say never. The manufacturing process is not perfect. Sometimes there's visual beads in those, not only the CFLs, but in your regular fluorescent bulbs. They're 4 footers, or 2 footers, or 8 foot tubes. Sometimes there will be actual visual mercury to clean up after them. Not very often, but in rare instances. Sue, have you had a chance to look at that question about the?
Yes.
I'm gonna turn over one of the questions to a toxicologist from the Institute for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry, because I do not know anything about the medical side of it, to be honest. And I'm having trouble getting this mic off me.
Hi, this is Sue Castile with the Agency for Toxic Substances and Disease Registry. I've worked with Eric on a lot of mercury spills here in Region 7. And the answer to the question about whether or not ingestion of mercury is a health concern is that very little mercury is actually absorbed through the GI tract. So unless you swallow a tremendous amount of mercury, you would never absorb enough through your GI tract to really be of health concern. Just as an example, we had a person here in our region, a teenager, who decided to try to commit suicide by swallowing mercury, and he actually swallowed several tablespoons full. And the only health problem that he developed from this was the fact that the mercury was trapped in his appendix, and they had to remove his appendix because it posed a hazard just because it was trapped in his appendix. So overall, we don't see a lot of absorption through the GI tract. We don't think it's a substantial or significant route of exposure. Really, inhalation is the primary concern that we have. But if you do have a parent who has a child that may have swallowed a small amount of mercury from a broken thermometer or something, they can always call the Poison Control Center. But we don't think it's a major concern in most cases.
And I want to go, based on the examples you just gave, which I mentioned earlier about the teenager trying to commit suicide and the appendix, let's go back to physicians not knowing anything about this. The surgeon that performed the appendectomy had never actually seen elemental mercury. So what's he do when he pulls the appendix out? Because it looks so cool under the x-rays. They did x-rays of the stomach, and that's why they realized that there was a lot of mercury in the appendix, which was causing the health problems. He removes the appendix and wants to see the mercury because he's never seen mercury before. What happens to the appendix and the mercury? He drops it in the emergency room. Mercury flies all over the floor in the emergency room. So the next response after we get done with the house was obviously the hospital at the emergency room. So that was a lead into at the very last page, going to, if you click on the resource button at the very last slide, there's a link there to fact sheets. And one of the fact sheets that Sue wrote up, which I'd asked for because of the issue of the physicians not really having a good grasp of this, is a fact sheet to inform physicians about the health risk and how to deal with mercury poisoning in their patients. So that's, there's a link to that on there, and so we take those with us, and whenever, you know, the responders are going out there are not medical people, so when the people being exposed are asking medical questions, we'll hand them a sheet and say, here, this is what you need to take to your doctor so they understand what you've been through and what to do now in the future. So I would highly recommend that. Also, we read a lot of school spills. Sue created one of those fact sheets for school nurses that is a little bit more technical than what we give to just the general residents, how to deal with children and exposure in a school scenario for the nurses. Let me get back to Sue. There's a couple more detailed questions of health risks that you probably can't read from where you're at. If you could come up and look at those while I'm looking at some of the other questions. Okay. Somebody wanted us to read the ATSDR tox profile for mercury on the website. The last time I looked at the tox profile for mercury, it was a very large document.
It's huge.
And I'm thinking over 100 pages, so I don't believe we're going to be able to read that today.
No, it's huge. But the information that we have on the fact sheets that we generated is summarized in the four fact sheets that Eric and I put together. Just to give you a brief overview of mercury, the entire document is available on the ATSDR website, but it is huge.
And I may have misinterpreted the question. They may be referring to that I need to look at the tox profile and reread it because I'm misinterpreting the urine testing. So I need to go back to it and relook at how the urine tests are conducted properly.
Well, I know that when we put together our information on the urine testing, we actually vetted it through the director of the Poison Control Center, ATSDR, and other physicians. So the information in the fact sheet is correct.
Okay. Next question on the list was, how can mercury be used in children's shoes? And that was banned here in the U.S. a long time ago. However, it's not banned worldwide, and so you can still get shoes that light up because of them and have mercury in them. And the beneficial use property that causes the shoes to light up in children's shoes is the electric conductivity. So basically there's a little, you know, complete connection and creates a path to the bulb and allows the sheath to light up and turn off, light up and turn off as the mercury, little bead of mercury is going back and forth and connecting the switch and disconnecting the switch. And I think I've covered the CFL question, probably not in enough depth, but there also on that fact sheet, there is a fact sheet specific to CFLs. So if you go back to that referencing, there is detailed information on how to deal with and clean up a CFL break. And I apologize, these questions are coming in fast enough, and it forces me to the top of the questions every time a new one comes in, so I'm having to find my way back to each of these questions. As far as provide a risk assessment around breaking one CFL bulb in a home, there's so many factors that I don't know that you could, and we went to the bottom again. There's so many outside factors that are involved in every single scenario. You got to ask all the right questions. Where did it break? What was the location? Who's being exposed? What's that room being used for? And go through that process, thought process for every single individual. And so basically what we have to do is talk in generalities. We generally speaking, we prefer that people switch to the CFLs because of the benefit outweighs the risk with bringing down the total emissions of mercury from coal from the power plants. Yet we want them to only place CFL bulbs in strategic locations, areas that there's a less likelihood of breakage. Do not put them in a lamp on the nightstand in a child's room. It's probably going to get broke. So think about where you replace the old bulbs with the new CFLs and make sure that they're strategically located. I'm going to switch now down to, well, actually, I didn't cover the reoccupation. Obviously, once we get the concentrations confidently down below our threshold, depending on what the scenario is, then we'll write up a memo back to the local health department to forward on, saying that, in our opinion, this domicile is habitable again, and we do not make that determination. That the local health department generally makes a determination that people are allowed to go back into their home at that point. If you slide down to, and I'm going to go back to, you know, obviously I'm going to have to go through a whole bunch of questions here at the end now, but I want to go ahead and finish out a lot of these slides, just to get them out of the way. The next slide, 42, I show these in my region here in EPA Region 7 just to have people have an idea of what mercury response equipment we have in each of our states and with EPA. It's just an example of some of the equipment that the state of Missouri has. Go down to slide 43, equipment the state of Kansas has and some of the local communities have to respond. Go down to slide 44, what the state of Nebraska had. One of the things that's unique about Nebraska is that they've done what they refer to on the bottom as this mercury bucket disposal project. And there is a few companies out there now that have set up a system where they've send, you know, for a few hundred dollars, you can have them send you disposal containers through the mail. And they basically, you can take mercury apparatus. Some companies require that the apparatus be intact. Some will allow broken apparatus to be placed in these buckets. When they get up to 1 pound of elemental mercury in them, then you close the lid on them, seal them, slap the mailing label on it, and ship it back to that company, and then they'll send you an empty one back to your place. Anyway, the state of Nebraska has set up a program where they have, I can't recall off the top of my head, but there's, I believe, like 135 locations spread throughout the entire state of Nebraska, so that people don't have to say that, you know, well, there's no place for me to take my stuff. You know, I don't have a place to take my old thermostat. I don't have a place to take my old mercury oil thermometer. Well, there actually is, and they have an online website where you can go on and see where the closest mercury bucket is. So I thought that's a pretty unique thing for the state of Nebraska. Iowa has got some new detection equipment. And then if you go down to slide 46, you can see that we have quite a bit of mercury response and cleanup equipment in EPA Region 7 in Kansas City and in St. Louis, our satellite office. And actually, that leads us to the final slide, which gets us to the slide 47, where you can go to the additional resources link. And if people want to go there and look at all those things, well, I've tried to. Gene, if you could come back on and let me know whether or not you're taking these questions off as they're coming up, so whether or not I've answered them already or not, because every time I get a new question that pops up, I lose my place on the questions, or if you want to just ask the questions for me.
I can certainly go ahead and start. I've been trying to remove them as you go along, but you're sort of jumping around at some of the questions, so I didn't want to remove it prematurely if you were going to come to it.
Okay.
So feel free to go ahead. Why don't you start at the bottom and then work your way up?
So, see, now we're talking. I'm at the bottom. It says, please note that mercury is, well, it's still shooting me to the top. I read a new question. It says, mercury is not mailable via the UPS, so the U.S. Postal Service. And I don't believe that any of those bucket programs that I was referring to, the different companies, use the United States Postal Service. I believe all of them use a private courier. And it is, once again, it is only for up to 1 pound of elemental mercury that it allows it. And this is based on the new universal waste rules that came out to try to accommodate small quantities and encourage recycling. And it says, how long does the mercury sniffing dog last? The answer to that was about 7 to 8 years. Working life of a working dog is generally 9 years. It takes about a year to 2 years to train one of these dogs to get them fully implemented. And I get a lot of questions about whether or not the exposure for the dogs is, you know, is bad. And it turns out that the medical monitoring program of those dogs is much greater than the medical monitoring I go through. They're tested quarterly for mercury toxicity, which I'm only done annually. And none of the mercury detection dogs, to my knowledge, have ever had any issues with overexposure. Basically, they go in, find it, and get right back out really quickly. They're extremely fast at finding the mercury. Very beneficial and very good outreach tool, too, because kids will sit down and listen to somebody that's working a dog versus some scientist coming into a class and trying to explain stuff to them from a textbook. So the dogs have been very useful and found thousands of pounds of built mercury in the schools up in Minnesota, and I'm off the top of my head, I'm forgetting, I think it was Sweden where the other two dogs were located.
Oh, we read over, okay.
Excuse me? And I got, one of the questions is, what's the actual level for mercury in air for residences? And the answer, once again, is it depends. The general rule of thumb is that the action level for residential settings in our region, at least, is between 300 nanograms and 1,000 nanograms, depending on what the situation is and who's being exposed. Some would say, you know, that's not good to have a range and have different scenarios, but the reality is that 1,000 is pretty low and has factors already built, safety factors already built into it. And the other general rule of thumb is if it's below 3,000 to 5,000 nanograms, if the concentrations are below that, there is not going to be any more visual elemental mercury left. Anytime that there's greater than 3,000 to 5,000 nanograms, I'd say 90 plus percent of the times I've been able to find one more bead. But anytime I get below that 3,000 or so threshold, there's generally not any more elemental mercury present, and so therefore the concentrations can't do anything but continue to decrease at that point. So that's the general rule as far as what's the threshold for residential spills. Questions are popping up quite rapidly now. I've got a question here. What should I do with mercury thermostat switch? There's actually another program. I've discussed very briefly this bucket project that was in the state of Nebraska. There is a national program for the Thermostat Recycling Corporation where the three big companies a few years back created this. I'm going to butcher this. I apologize. But created basically a method of recycling mercury thermostats. And you can go online, you type in Google search or internet search for the Thermostat Recycling Corporation, or TRC, and it'll come up and it'll tell you, you can type in your zip code, I believe, and it'll give you a facility near your zip code, usually a hardware store or something similar to that, where they have joined the program and you can take your thermostats in for recycling. There's a lot more to that program than I've explained, but I don't know the exact details of it. And I've got a question. What are the habitat levels for mercury? I absolutely have no idea how to answer that question, to be honest. And that's one I would have to think on for quite a while. I'm not going to be able to answer that one right out of the gate. Next one says, can you ask Sue to encourage ATSDR to put the mercury case studies and environmental medicine booklet on their website? He's just temporarily walked out, but I will make sure I ask her to. Also about the tox profile from ATSDR, it is in sections, and so you can glance at the sections rapidly, so it is a good reference tool, and it is online. So I appreciate that comment. From a layman's perspective, is EPA cleanup scenario sufficient to eliminate the concerns related to breaking of a CFL thermostat or thermometer? I routinely direct callers to EPA's guidance. I would say yes, it is. And once again, I'll fall back to you. If it wasn't, we would be hearing back from physicians and doctors by now of of cases of exposure after the fact because of an insufficient policy or that's causing us not to do cleanups or from an insufficient cleanup that we actually conducted. And I am not aware of a single case where there's been a post exposure scenario based on our actions. Never say never, but I'm not personally aware of any. Once again, Sue had walked out, so that wanted to know the actual health effects of mercury exposure, and that basically it's neurological. There's certain target organs, kidneys, mainly central nervous system is the ones that I'm most concerned about. The kidney failure and the central nervous system are the two biggest ones that I'm aware of, and if Sue would come back in, I'd let her go into that in more detail, but not being a doctor, I don't want to go down that path any further. You can find all kind of scenarios online, and they're all quite accurate, the most of the ones I've ever read, but not being a doctor, I don't want to attempt to answer that any further. How high is high? What is mercury evolved to life so well if the vapor pressure is so low? How high is high? Most of the instruments stop taking the readings after 200,000 nanograms or so. High is any time you can visually see the mercury. If you see mercury beads that are not enclosed or encapsulated or sealed properly, levels will be, once again, unless it's negative 38 degrees, levels will be high enough that there is going to be a problem. So that's any time you can see the mercury and it's not enclosed or sealed, it's going to be a problem. Oh, yes, I need to get back to the rebound question. I have personally done probably three or four very large mercury spills, which had been historical spills that occurred and had not been cleaned up for many years. And during those many years, those vapors had the opportunity to completely saturate entire rooms, entire buildings, entire homes, and all the porous media, all the way to the wood, anything that was porous, was basically saturated because there was a large quantity spilled and it was left unattended for many years. Went in and cleaned up all the visual, and during that cleanup had ventilation set up properly, so we might, at the end of the day, get very, very low readings, less than 1,000. Come back the next morning, and turns out we're back up to 10,000 plus. I believe that's the rebound you're probably referring to. Well, basically, those porous items that were grossly saturated, it is going to take a long time for them to enhance the vapors that have. Once those vapors go to a porous item, they bind with that item, and the only way to drive it back off is to increase the heat in the area and continue to ventilate. Well, so it's very common for us, once we do a cleanup and get all the visual gone, we'll start doing what we refer to as a heat and vent cycling. We'll take the temperature in the exposed area up from room temperature of 75 up to approximately 95 to, I would not exceed 105. I've experimented with that and got negative results whenever I realized I was damaging a lot of the things in the home at greater than 105 for 12 hours in a row. Candles start melting, computers crap out. There's a lot of things that don't like 105 degrees for an extended period of time. So less than 105, but 95 to 105 is kind of the general rule of thumb. Evacuating so that basically you're constantly pulling the vapors that are coming back. You're driving up the temperature to allow them to desorb off of the items that they've been absorbed to. That can take a very long time. We do that same process for a week, 2 weeks in a row, and we're still having that same rebound problem. We start doing destructive measures on the room that's where the spill had occurred. I've gutted an entire home before, down to just the outer frame of a home and the foundation. Actually, part of the foundation even came out, and until I was actually able to stop the rebound from occurring. Another part of the rebound in the home I just referenced, where I gutted the whole thing, I was constantly finding beads of mercury on the floor of the basement every morning when we went back in. Basically, we would increase the temperature overnight, let the stuff come out, and in the morning when we brought the temperature back down, it would recondense in the lowest part of the house and reform into little bitty microbeads. And I couldn't believe it for several days, and I finally started putting tape around a small area to verify. I personally cleaned it up, nothing visual, came back the next morning, and it's, sure enough, there's some little microbeads in the same spot the next morning. So basically the rebound is a direct correlation to how grossly saturated the porous items in that area are. And until you've done enough heat and vent cycles, it's going to continue. The old Christmas ornaments that were coated with mercury hazardous. Once again, the reason I leave that one slide, what mercury devices and apparatus are you aware of? One of the reasons I leave that on there is because I love hearing things I've never heard of before. I've never heard of mercury ornaments being dipped in mercury, so I can't answer that. But I will look into that now that I know that that's another thing that had mercury. Next one, can I decon things to reuse, like an expensive dental chair? Yes, decon is possible, but not always successful. I've deconned things that I thought would never be able to be done, i.e. carpet. I've actually done it before whenever it was some, very expensive ornamental rug. It was successful, but it took a long time and a lot of effort and money. And generally, we have to do cost-benefit analysis on things. If there's reasons to go beyond and above normal based on, what my hourly cost is and my contractor's hourly costs are, we may or may not spend the time on it. Some things decon quite easily. Some wood furniture could be deconned real easily, even though it's been in direct contact because of how the wood was finished. Some wood furniture can't be deconned because of how it's finished. It's going to vary from article to article, and you just got to, the only way to verify that is decon it, encapsulate it with plastic, let it sit out, in the sun or higher temperature for a little while, and take a reading inside of the airspace inside the plastic to see whether or not it's coming down or still staying at high concentrations.
Eric?
Yes.
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
This is Marion Heyman from Connecticut. I'm really interested in your the heat vent cycling that you were talking about for rebound.
Yes.
Would you recommend that be done routinely? And I'm asking this because we've had many school situations where the contractor's clean, we monitor, everything looks good, come back the next day, find beads. So now I'm wondering if this is something routine we should recommend.
Basically, I never recommend any heat involved while there's still visible mercury present. A lot of people, in my opinion, and this is a personal preference. You go to different regions and different responders do things a little bit different. I personally do not allow increased heat until I decrease the heat. I increase ventilation, decrease heat until I believe I've gotten all visual elemental mercury recovered. Once I have no more visual elemental, and you do that using your instruments, obviously. Once you've got all this easy stuff picked up and you come back in, and start using your instruments, and then sure enough, it'll point you to another bead, and then get that clean area cleaned up and bring it back in, and sure enough, it'll point you to another area. Anyway, when you're done with that and you can't find any more areas that give you a spike with your instrumentation, then you can safely say, I found all the visible mercury I could find. Now let's switch over from just the physical removal and ventilation process and switch to heat and ventilation process. That can be done if you're, that's something that you could set up automatic with timers to occur during the night whenever the contractors go to bed. Set up the heat, leave the heat run, and establish a temperature of 90 to 95 in a school in the area. That's, hopefully you've sealed that particular area of the school off. Try and get it up to 90, 95, and then have an exhaust fan system set up. And the exhaust fan system is actually, that's another, I could almost do a two-hour class on how to do that properly. We're not just talking about a box window fan sitting in the floor of a hallway. That's not going to do it. You need to think in terms of a fireman with a building completely, engulfed in smoke. How would you remove that smoke instantaneously? Well, you're going to need high volume airflow through there, and you're going to want to suck all of that you know, go back to the videos and the smoke thought process. You need to pull that smoke out of there rapidly. Then allow the, you know, so we actually do use the smoke fans that fire departments use. That's what we carry. And we'll set it up so that the heat gets up there for an hour or two. Therefore, the materials that had absorbed vapors in them start releasing those vapors. You can envision a room starting to fill up with the smoke, i.e. the vapors. Then the fan automatically kicks on from a timer switch, sucks the volume of air out of that room for maybe 5 minutes. All the air now is clean of those vapors, shuts it back off, allow the heat to go back up to a higher temperature because that's going to drop your temperature also, allow the temperature to go back up for an hour or two. The automatic switch kicks the fan back on, it sucks it back outside for 5 minutes, shut it back down. And that's what I refer to as a heat vent cycle. It's set up properly. Does that answer your question?
Yes, but so following what you're saying, so the contractor's clean, and everybody thinks that it's totally clean. As a routine, would you recommend then doing just what you described as the final?
Yes, and if that didn't work, then guess what happened? Go back to one of the previous slides I talked about.
Yeah, well, right, then they have to start again.
No, you got to go back to your drains. You probably have a drain situation where you got mercury in a drain. Toilet, shower, sink, a chemistry lab, one of those, you actually, if it's not working, you still have mercury. You just haven't found where it's at.
I'm talking about if we have a known spill, not, for example, if someone dumped it down a drain.
On a school?
Well, schools, homes, but schools.
Yeah, but your scenario was a school. You never have a known spill on a school. You have
we do a lot because we have kids bringing it to school.
But you also have unknowns. You have spills in schools that you may or may not see when you respond to a known scenario because they may or may not, the contractor may or may not have ever gone down a certain hallway or into a certain closet.
True.
But it's very rare, at least to my knowledge, it's very rare to do a whole school assessment, a complete detailed whole school assessment every time there's a spill. It's usually go straight to the known, clean up the visual, and then you figure out the other stuff down the road if you don't do it right the first time.
Yeah, you're right. So then would it be a good idea for schools, let's say, to institute this policy to do what you just described, this heat vent cycling, after you know, we believe the cleanup to be complete?
It is the final polishing technique.
Okay. Love it. Thank you.
Going back to questions. Are there any Hopglide or Curalite-based home mitigation solutions? Actually, I think I have heard of that out there before. I'm not personally familiar with them, so I can't answer that question. I'm sorry. Could the TCLA standards be considered dated and not sensitive? That's opening a big policy wound that I don't know if I want to go down. I can't answer that, whether or not TCLP is done correctly or accurately. There's always been questions of whether or not TCLP is the right method for determining leachability. Actually, had a that would have probably helped me with that, and she's gone at the moment.
Hey, Eric, can you take another question?
Sure.
Eric, I'm Matthew from California. I wanted to ask a question. You addressed just briefly the last vocal question in regards to the mercury making it to the drain. And I want to ask in regards to the scenario of a dentist's office in regards to a broken apple of dental amalgam that maybe suspectably fell down into a drain. Now, we're suspecting that most of that would be collected at the P-trap in that drain. After you remove that P-trap, what are the next steps that you go through to ensure that nothing and no residuals are left in the drain? And do you do any testing or monitoring at the wastewater release from that building or that office?
There's several questions in there. One is, no, it's not all contained in the P-trap. The vast majority will be, but never say never. A lot of it does get past the P-trap in dental offices. I want to refer to, if people do some research, go to do some research on the city of Wichita, Kansas. Did a study, I believe it was about 3 years ago, where they had issues with their wastewater treatment facility with very high levels of mercury coming into their system and killing their bugs and not being able to figure out and pinpoint a source. So they got some funding and did some elaborate testing, and they basically proved without a shadow of a doubt that their sources of mercury getting into the wastewater system were directed right back to the dental offices in the town, in the city of Wichita. And therefore they've been able to work with the dental offices, even though they're not required by law at the moment, I don't believe, to institute trap devices. Which I believe are on the market now. You can also do research on that, where many dental offices are now installing specialty trap systems. It's not just from, you mentioned a very specific source of mercury falling into the drain. It's from just doing regular cleanings and regular routine dental work. You are going to be getting a small quantity of mercury off the mercury amalgams from historical fillings. And it is probably the major source of, in fact, I think it has been quoted as the major source of mercury in the wastewater treatment systems. And so I would highly suggest people go out and look for that that report that was done by the city of Wichita, Kansas. And Sedgwick County Health Department also was involved in it, I believe. Does that answer your question?
Partially, yes, and I'll go and investigate further in that reference, that research that you've given me. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And the reason that the P-trap isn't going to be solely, if it was pure mercury, it would probably, the vast overwhelming majority of the mercury itself would stop in the P-trap. However, it's generally not strictly just mercury. The mercury by itself will settle out at the bottom of the P-trap, and the water by itself won't be able to flush it past that and into the system. However, once it's been amalgamated, and it's not just elemental mercury by itself, the amalgamated mercury can get flushed a little easier past.
Right. It's copper and silver and everything else that comes with it.
Yes. The water can flush it once it's been bound already. But when it's by itself, it's a lot harder for water to flush the mercury up and over that P-trap.
Okay. Thank you.
Got a question in the room. Oh. I'll explain that later. Got a time zone question. What is the solubility of mercury in oil instead of underwater? Man, it keeps jumping around. Well, I can't find that question again now, but I have absolutely no idea what solubility in oil is. I don't know if oil is better and has a higher saturation potential for mercury vapors than water does. I honestly have no idea. I'm not a chemist by any stretch of the imagination, by the way. I should have stated that up front. I've got a question in here. I briefly discussed responding to an outdoor mercury spill. Exposure is not the driver for cleanup, but the potential impact of water quality. How clean is clean? How do we handle residual? Basically, physical cleanup, outdoor scenario, we do physical cleanups. If it's soil, we excavate. Then it's very problematic outdoors because every time you try to clean it up, it falls back out and goes deeper. Falls back out and goes deeper. So, you know, I could dig to where some of the people online are at right now before we got to the bottom of it. But you do the best you can. And one of the, and how do you know how clean is clean? One of the techniques that we've used with the mercury vapor analyzers, since they only do air. And, well, actually, there are attachments for, like the Lumex instrument has attachments where you could analyze for solids and liquids. So if you have that, you can actually collect a sample of the soil and run it through that. So you can collect a sample of soil and send it to the laboratory, and different states have different levels where they say it's clean. I think 200 ppm is kind of a general rule of thumb. If it exceeds 200 ppm, keep digging. If it's below 200 ppm, you're probably clean enough. One of the techniques that we use with our handheld air instruments, though, for mercury vapor line analyzers, you might cover it up with black tubs. And once you've cleaned up what you could see, cover that area with a bunch of black tubs, drill a hole through the top of the tubs after they've sat in the sun for a little while, and push your mercury vapor line analyzer probe through the top of the hole and take ambient air readings off the top of that. If you get high readings, you still get, you know, in excess of 3,000, 5,000, and you still got elemental mercury there, so you know that there's some in that area. You just move the tubs around until you have done a thorough assessment of where all the mercury was, and now that you've got, you know, whether or not you've got it all cleaned up. I could go into a lot more detail on that, but there's many ways to deal with outdoor spills, but that's one of the ways that we do it.
Eric, this is June. I hate to cut in on it, but we're running up at our scheduled end time of 3 p.m. Eastern, and I know that we have a number of questions that will probably continue to come in if we keep going with this. So if there's one or two last questions you want to address, I'll go ahead and give you an extra minute or two to do so. But anything that we didn't actually hit on today, what I'm going to do is copy all this information and email it out to you, and if you want to follow up with the questions that we couldn't cover, you'll be able to respond to the participants that asked them directly.
Okay. There was one other that you can probably answer about credits, whether the people that are watching this get credits for it, so you can answer that. And yeah, I'll if you summarize all these questions that I have not answered, and I'll follow up with a written answer later.
And great, that's exactly what I'll do.
Hopefully I have and, more time here today, and it followed along with what the title intended, but I would refer everybody back to the additional resources link on the last slide and some of the reports that I referenced that I don't have linked up there.
And I'm definitely sure we're going to get a lot of positive feedback to that. In fact, referring to the feedback, if I could direct everybody to the final slide, which is slide number 47, that's where you'll find those two links that Eric has been talking about. The first one is the link to additional resources, where you'll see a number of documents and the movie clips as well as today's materials to download. You can feel free to share that URL with anyone that you like. And Eric, if there are additional documents that you'd like to post there after today's session, you can pass them to me and we'll get them up there as well. The second link on slide number 47 is the link to our online feedback form. If you could just take a minute or two to fill that out to let us know what you thought of the presentation, how effective it was, well delivered, if you thought it was useful, expenditure of your time, that's how we get the feedback and make sure that we continue to deliver online technical training like this. Also, the question in reference to getting credit, the credit will vary depending on the organization, the types of credits. If you're looking for PEUs, if you're looking for CEUs, PDHs, it all varies by organization and who's tracking the training. Usually, we don't track that material ourselves, but our participants in the past have oftentimes taken copies of the slides, the agenda, and the confirmation email that verifies that they participated and submitted that to receive credit from their tracking organization. So if you need confirmation of your participation, go ahead and fill out that feedback form and check the box asking for a confirmation email, and that will be sent to you for your records. So with that, I think I'm going to close things out just a little bit past our scheduled end time. I want to extend my thanks to Eric for presenting today. This was really a great session. Usually we can tell by measure of the number of questions that are coming in how well you've done, and you had a huge number come in today, and I think we'll continue to see a few more follow or flow in after the session's over. So again, thank you, Eric, for your time, as well as your colleagues who helped answer some of the questions. I want to thank the organizers from OSU Readiness who put this session together, as well as all of the participants from all over the world. We actually had people from Brazil, people from Canada, and all over the U.S. attending today. Final reminder, this session was recorded, and it will be archived and put up on the Kulin website in approximately 1 to 2 weeks so that you can download this in a variety of formats and replay and share with your coworkers. So I want to thank you all again for joining us and hope that I will see you again on another Kulin Internet Seminar soon. Thanks very much, and this will be the formal end of the session.